give him bran.
Atat sheyayin, you drink wine, yashan, aged to perfection. Buhu shote yayin chadash, and he gets the lousy stuff. He gets the lousy yayin, the new stuff. Ata yashan agave mochim, you sleep on pillows. Buhu yashan agave ateven, and he's going to sleep on straw. If you're going to have a nice bed, make sure, what? He has one too. Mikan amru kol hakone eved ivri. Anyone who acquires a Hebrew slave, kakone adon la'atzmo, acquires for himself a master. So it's obviously talking about the category of Eved Ivri, which is categorically different than Eved Kanani, a Hebrew slave versus a Canaanite slave. However, the lesson comes in of itself in a quippy way to say that you're going to have a master over you if you have this person to take care of. And the same is true for the Eved Kanani. The same is true for the entire system. And I just point out again, why is it interesting to us that it's in the laws of Kiddushin and in the laws of Gittin that we get all these laws about slavery to begin with? Because we are interested, said positively, in the lives of our slaves, the Avadim, in terms of their relationships, who they can marry and who they can't marry, but also whether or not someone falls in love with someone who's a slave, what is the ruling and what is the status of that person, and with Eved Kanani specifically, are they allowed to marry within the Jewish people or are they not? These are like on the cusp questions of are you really freeing this person to get married to a Jewish person? And again, it's my sense that we deal with some of these laws in these areas because we're thinking about the relationships they have, and we're thinking about the expansion of our people. Tosfot says the following on that page: Kol hakone eved ivri kakone adon atzmo. Whoever gets a slave is like getting a master. V'kashe. Difficult to understand what they mean. My Adon. What does it really mean he's acquiring a master? I mean, after all, one is not the other's property. Dailo liot Adono. The master is still the master. V'yesh lomar kadizabir Yerushalmi. Tosfot do their classic thing, where they're not only reading across the entire Bavli, the entire Babylonian Talmud, to bring sources that might shed some light on what we're studying now, we're learning now, we're trying to define now. But they go to sources that are even outside the Babylonian Talmud itself, to the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud. Now we know that the Jerusalem Talmud is finished earlier than the Babylonian Talmud. 4th century, 5th century maybe. And the Tosafot have it on the shelf as they're learning out our Talmud, and they sometimes will bring proofs or challenges or parallel texts or comments from that Jerusalem Talmud. Okay. Depamim ein lo. Sometimes he will only have elakar echad, one pillow. Im shochev alav ba'atzmo, and if the master takes it for himself, eino mikayem ki tov lo imach, and it wouldn't be a fulfillment of the verse in the Torah, of the commandment in the Torah, that it should be he should be good with you, should be good for him with you. V'imeno shochev alav, if he doesn't sleep on it, v'gam eino mosro la'avdo, and does not give it to the slave, zo midat sdom. That's the manner of Sodom. You know, be careful, Jewish people. You don't want to be like Sodomite. Nimsa she'alkach tzarich limsor la'avdo v'hainu adon la'atzmo. As a result, he must give it to the slave who thus becomes the master. He explains what it can mean. And he takes it further, the Rishami does at least, and the Tosfot are quoting it, to say it's unethical entirely. It's the level of Sodom. Well, so what's the level of Sodom really all about? It's that they had all kinds of bigotry and whatever you associate with Sodom Vamora, you associate with this kind of person. So it's an interesting piece that comes up as an ethical teaching in the midst of all the laws about who can marry who and how a Kanani marries a Kanani. And we're, of course, in the laws of Gittin and the laws of divorce, and we're talking about Eved Kanani, slave, the Canaanite slave within our midst. And we're remembering that we're in the Tikkun Olam of that landscape. We'll get another, and as we turn back to our Gemara, we're going to get to a certain part that we've read already. But I want you to see that part now, like we did the last time, in light of what comes before it. In light of the context of the discussion. And again, what part of what I'm suggesting is that the Tikkun Olam that comes out of our chapter about the whole system of not only how we treat our individual Eved Kanani, an individual Kanaanite slave, but it's even how we think about our property and what constructs or categories we're using to think about these people within our midst. And asking questions like, can we really think of the guy this way? Can we really think of the guy that way? Or do we need to just fix things so that there can be a possibility that A, they live a life that has some decency to it, and B, they live a life that has some decency to it, and they might even become part of the Jewish people. Okay, so if a person would throw their lot in with the Jewish people, if I move past economic realities and I can get them to be just part of the whole free people of my society, is that really the Tikkun Olam that we're going for? And I believe this stretch of text asks that question. You may either agree with me or you may disagree with me by the time we're done with the passage. Because you may say, no, we're simply talking about how we deal with property. And that a slave either gets permission to marry or not within the context of being a slave, and that's all we're talking about, permission or not permission. But I think it goes beyond that.
So, the relation of slave and master, as explained here, what will be the relation of somebody that we hire to work for us, not as a slave, but for a fee, and he lives in our domain?
Nice. So guess what? There's a little bit of relating to even that question within the context of the Gemara we're going to read, because I believe that is a natural question that grows out of this entire discussion and these subjects. Philosophically, the question is, if I treat an Eved Kanani like this, if I treat an Eved Ivri like this, what does it mean when I'm actually hiring a worker? Is that person, Ke'ilu, like a slave to me right now?
You should get more.
Maybe. So I think you're onto something. It's a good question. At least in the Gemara we're going to look at, there's a little bit of relating to it, right? How you treat a worker is a whole area of Jewish law that in and of itself has Gemara about it and Talmud about it. I don't want to go into those right now, except to say that I think your question is a natural outgrowth of the discussion we're in, and you'll see one spot where I made a note that said, it's not about the Eved Kanani here, it's not about the actual slave, it's actually about how we relate to workers. Okay? Good. 39A1.
39?
Yeah. Lamed Ket Aleph. Okay, for this we need to know the following. We need to know about the principle of Me'ilah. If I consecrate property to the Beit HaMikdash, and I say that this property is the property of the Beit HaMikdash, and it's movable property, am I allowed to use that movable property, gain from it? No. I've consecrated it to the Beit HaMikdash. If I say the value of my land that I own over here in plot A, and say I have it divided up into 7 plots, plot A is going to be consecrated to the Beit HaMikdash. Unlike movable property, I can gain from that which grows. The land is the land. But the growth and the output, the tota'ah, that I can gain from. That's the basic concept. Let's move forward and see how that plays out here.
Wait, so you're not giving all of it?
Well, you are giving the land once either you sell it. You're going to give the value.
But the proceeds?
You're going to give the proceeds of the land, but maybe while I still own the land. Okay? I am going to ultimately not really gain from it. Or gain from it. Right? Those are the questions. And so those are the questions that are alive in the times of the Talmud about what can I gain from and what may I not gain from. Okay. And it may go one way or another depending on the argument of the Gemara, and we'll see here in a minute. We're going to be discussing the application of the law of Me'ila to a slave who is consecrated by his master. There is a Braita that talks about this prohibition of Me'ila. This is a prohibition, the misuse of sacred temple property. One who mistakenly commits Me'ila must pay what he used plus a fifth. That's the ultimate punishment. Pay what you use plus a fifth. Okay? Now, reality, again, is that let me just read you one other thing. A free man is not a saleable object, just to think in large terms about the system. Rashi brings that up in the midst of the whole thing. Therefore, it cannot be assigned a market value. So it says the Braita must be explained as meaning that the person meant to pledge his value to the temple treasury, but did not consecrate himself in any manner. That's a free man. And therefore what? A free man within this whole system who consecrates his own value, can he work? Yes. Because it's as if he was a slave figuring out a value. So we don't say that he's property and therefore completely consecrated to the Beit HaMikdash. Okay? So just remember that piece too. Let's push forward. I'm on the right-hand side of the page if you're following with me, 39A1. Lema Katana A. Do we have a Tanaitic dispute here? Hamakdish avdo ein moalin lbo. If one consecrates his slave, the slave is not subject to Me'ila, says the Braita. So if I say what? I'm going to give the value of my slave to the Beit HaMikdash. Then what? I could still put him to work. Not being not subject to Me'ila means I could use him. Still put him to work. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, but Shimon ben Gamliel says, Moalin Bisaro. His hair is subject to Me'ila. Okay? Now, what does that really mean? His hair is subject to Me'ila. You can't use his hair.
I mean, they're talking about his body in general.
Slaves, items for property.
I'm sorry. We're not using it. We're in the book. 39A1. I'm going to leave the question open. What is this hair? Is it hair, physical hair? Is it symbolic of something? And what is it symbolic of? And by the way, I'll just tell you now, Steinsaltz doesn't comment on what is the hair, what is hair used for, what is it symbolically, is it talking metaphorically, and neither does Art Scroll. Okay, so I think that the question is left open in the text. What is it really trying to get to? Telling you up front what I'm thinking. But I really want to, I'm interested in what your sense of the text is really all about when it comes to this discussion. Because we're going to talk a lot about his hair. Who said body, by the way? Okay. If it's just a code for his entire personhood, and it's just a different way to say it, I'll agree that you could continue to think that and you can continue to see that through the whole sugya. It's just a different way to say it. So that you can kind of use the metaphor that they're going to use, or use the analogy.
Distinguishing between his labor and his personhood.
Could be. Or distinguishing between
what is and what grows.
Yeah, kind of who is he, or what grows of this slave? What is the output of this person?
Or it's the least substantial part of him.
Could be. Could be. Let's now go into the text and see where we go. The Gemara explains the dispute. My love, baha kamiflage. Now, it's not that they dispute the issue of whether a slave can be consecrated. Demar Savar Kadosh, Umar Savar Lo Kadosh. For one master, Rabbi Shimon holds the slave is consecrated, and the other master, the Tanakama, holds the slave is not consecrated. But Tisbara, but consider this explanation. Hi, Molin Bo V'Ein Molin Bo. The Braita's statement of their dispute is as follows. Braita being one of the oldest forms of Mishnah rabbinic text we have, that is tucked within the Gemara's text by the editors. Rabbi Shimon holds that the slave is subject to Me'ilah. That once you consecrated the slave to the Beit HaMikdash, how could you possibly use the slave? And the Tanakama holds, what's the Tanakama? The first opinion of a Tanaitic text. A Braita is a Tanaitic text, therefore a Tanakama is the first opinion of a Tanaitic text. The Tanakama holds that the slave is not subject to Me'ilah. Well, Hai Kadosh Ve'eno Kadosh Mibayle. Rather, the Braita needs to state things in a little bit of a more precise way. Rabban Shimon holds that the slave is consecrated, and the Tanakama holds the slave is not consecrated. It's not about Me'ilah.
Can you define Me'ilah again?
Me'ilah is using property that you've already consecrated to the Beit HaMikdash. And is illegal because if you do, you have to pay back the amount plus a fifth.
So if I gave property of a slave to the temple, who allows me to use it? If I gave it, I'm not a master of this property.
I set it aside. I keep it in my precinct. The next time I'm going to the Jerusalem temple, I'm going to bring it with me. It's still around. Or it's the land.
I promise I neder. It's like a neder.
It's like that.
So it's called
Haktasha. It's called Makdish.
So it's not yet there. It's in my possession, but it's intended to be.
Yeah. Okay. Eila dechule alma kadosh. But we know everybody agrees that a slave can be consecrated. V'hacha b'hai kamifalge. And here's really what they're arguing about. Demar sevar avda demikarkae dame. One master, the Tanakama, who said what? What's the Tanakama's position?
Like a land.
No, wait. What's the Tanakama's position in the original? If one consecrates his slave, he's not subject to Me'ilah. So the Tanakama holds that he's considered kakarka edame, that he's considered as land. Just as one does not commit Me'ilah by benefiting from consecrated land, so too does one not commit Me'ilah by benefiting from consecrated slaves. Umar Savar, right? When it's set up Mar Savar and Mar Savar, it goes according to the order of the teachings that we had back in the original teaching, the original Braita. So Mar equals 1, Mar equals 2. But Mar, who is Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, says, what? That his hair is subject to Me'ilah, and that what? Slaves are considered K'mitaltele Dame. Slaves are considered like movable property, and since I know that with movable property, if I consecrate them to the Beit HaMikdash, I can't really benefit from them, and if I use it, I have to pay all what I owe plus a fifth, that I can't really use that slave. Now,
so that's in conflict to what you said before, because I cannot take the land to Beit HaMikdash. I can take a slave to Beit HaMikdash, to the temple.
I keep in my mind that the value of my land I'm giving to the Beit HaMikdash.
And I didn't sell it yet.
And I didn't exchange it for money. I don't have the money right now. Okay. So that's the issue. Is the slave like land?
Or
movable property. The Gemara refutes this explanation as well, though. Ihachi, if so, the dispute concerns whether the Tanna Kamma holds that slaves have the same status as land for those laws of Me'ilah. Adamiflagei besaro liflagu begufo. Then rather than dispute regarding whether one commits Me'ilah by benefiting from a consecrated slave's hair, the Tanna Kamma and Rabbi Shimon should dispute regarding whether one commits Me'ilah by benefiting from a consecrated slave's body. What are you bringing up, hair? Now, what's the hair on a slave? Just to kind of think about it in terms of the land versus the body.
Because you can cut it and it grows.
You can cut it and it grows. Okay, that explanation, though, is going to be discussed. Eila dechule alma av de kemekarek edami. Rather, everyone agrees, suggests the Gemara here. In other words, like this. But doesn't everyone agree that slaves are considered as land? And regarding that, one doesn't commit me'ilah, even if he benefits from the what? From the body or the hair of the slave. V'hacha b'saro ha'omed ligazez kamifalge. But here in the brisa, the Tanna Kamma and Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel dispute what? Specifically regarding a consecrated slave's hair that's what? Ready to be cut. What does that mean? That he's talking about the hair that's kind of extra long. Needs to be cut. Mar savara ki gazuz dami. Rabban Shimon holds that such hair is considered as if it had already been cut. Therefore, it has the status of what? Movable property. And one commits me'ilah if one benefits from it. Let's go back to the land metaphor. If I cut a certain amount of harvest and I say this part of the harvest is consecrated, is dedicated to the Beit HaMikdash, right? Then that means what? I sell that fruit, I bring the money. If I benefit from that fruit by either eating it or not selling it, giving it away, do I have the money that I pledged? No. Back to the slave. I have extra long hair. Am I allowed to benefit a little bit, though, from the land that I pledged, if the person's land? If I have a harvest? Yeah, I said yes, right? So therefore, it's a little bit. But if I say that everybody regards the slave as land, why would I even have a question? Umar savar lov kagazuz dame, and the other master says, that hair is not considered as if it had already been cut. Hence, the slave has the status of land and one does not commit me'ilah if he benefits from it. Now, Tell me what the whole hair discussion's about.
I didn't know that they used to sell the cut hair to somebody.
Okay. If it is about the ancient practice of using human hair for some kind of market value, because we're talking about the value of slaves and actually cutting it, what's fascinating to me, just from the standpoint of the two books that I have in front of me that are, you know, in the world today, this book and this book, nobody mentioned that. Yeah.
So what is Shitat Kadmonim?
That is not the culture that they wanted to get into in these pieces. It is possible that human hair was used for some purpose in the ancient world. Right? We know that ancient wig makers tried all kinds of things with different hairs, just like we have that possibility today. And I know a woman who makes wigs out of human hair and does it in a very, very righteous way instead of trying to break the bank of all the very orthodox women who want various ones of different colors and only the best and finest human hair. At one time, I don't know if you remember, about 10, 15 years ago, this was a very, very big ethical issue and the prices were astronomical and there were articles in every kind of newspaper concerning the issue. But this woman in Teaneck, she's a beautician, not Jewish, but uses hair that people donate in order to make wigs for people who are going through cancer treatments. And we know that this is a very, very holy matter for a lot of people who really do want hair of their own during these times. There are women, though, who buy one and they have hair that is well-groomed looking and that it does hold its form and shape more naturally in the Orthodox community where there are wigs. Some communities believe in having no wigs at all and wouldn't use such hair. And the question is, how long does that go back? And frankly, I'm not telling you that I looked at every source that has investigated the whole history of wig making, but it is possible that we're talking a little bit about this industry. Again, none of the texts in front of us are here. They don't say that. Now, there's another real possibility in my mind. Pillows they had, from what I understand, they had straw pillows, they had feather pillows, which were common, and sometimes they would use more kind of hide that still had some of the hair on it. Fluffy wool could be used, but that didn't, actually that became a little too pressed. So what is the hair when it comes to trying to figure out for the slave if we can, quote unquote, use his hair and not suffer me'ila and not abuse him? If he was land, could we still put him to work?
Yeah.
The answer is yes, according to the laws of Me'ila, if we're trying to do some comparison to the realm of law.
But by the way, land is interesting. Land, you did the work long before you kidashtai the Lebet HaMikdash,
mm-hmm.
before you. And then you can get the fruit like a season later.
Mm-hmm.
A slave need to, if you want to enjoy his food, it's a daily work. It's like moment by moment. It's not exactly the same, although they are doing parallel between the two of them. But
mm-hmm.
The fruits of the land are 4, 5, 6, 8 months later,
mm-hmm.
maybe sometimes years. So there is a gap between the time schedule of Me'ila for the land or Me'ila for the slave.
How does that come down to where the dispute is being left here in the Braita, the Tana, comma, and Rabbi Shimon dispute regarding a consecrated slave's hair that's ready to be cut? Tana, comma, and Rabbi Shimon. Here's the disagreement. Mar Savar Kagazuz Dami, one master, Rabbi Shimon, holds that such hair has the status of movable property, and therefore, what? If it's movable property, you cannot use it. And one commits me'ilah if he benefits from it. Umar Savar Lav Kagazuz Dami, and the other master, the Tana Kama, holds that such hair is not considered.
Feeling like we're speaking a little bit about the dignity of the slave at the same time, because it's not about his hair that's been cut. It's his hair is ready to be cut, and whether he's still, whether it's still part of him until his decision's made as to whether or not it's actually been removed from him. It's whether he controls his body or not, whether he controls, it doesn't make it clear whose decision it is. They're talking about whether a part of the slave is still part of the slave or not. The fact that it's ready to be cut, why would that separate it from him?
On economic terms, sounds like there might be a code of how long hair can be, and once the hair grows to a certain length, then I can actually cut it. And use
can,
it.
You can cut it from your slave.
That's right.
Without his consent, you say.
Sounds like that. In other words, if the question is whether or not I own the hair that grows off of his body, her body, so that I can sell it to the wig market, this passage could be answering simply from economic terms that you can do so. Philosophically, I can get to you in a second, Ari?
Yeah.
Philosophically, there is a dignity issue. At what point does a person's physicality also become part of what I own?
Yeah, unless culturally that issue didn't exist. I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
Conceivable too.
What were we going to say?
Land is stationary, slave is mobility. Even though it's questioned, how about animals? Do they have the same rule as a slave then, in terms of because they're mobile, they have hair, or would they have other things that could be used, or are we talking only specifically about a slave?
We're talking right now only specifically about a slave. I definitely owned the wool of my sheep at any length.
Even up to
sounds like
the
here.
The sheep is very commercial. Hair may be questionable.
Yeah, well, here it sounds at least like this. Here's the other part of the how much, in terms of the dignity issue, how much hair can I really take and how much hair not? Seems like there is some measure here within this discussion of how long a person's hair may grow before I own it and may ultimately bring it to market, if I'm talking about bringing it to market, or I may decide that they just need to look like the next slave with their hair that way. There's a couple of ways to think about the control that people exhibited on the human individuals who made up the ranks of slaves. We see in certain wall carvings, right, very uniform looking slaves by way of heads. I looked at a few of the kind of ancient Egyptian ones. I looked at a few of the Near Eastern ones. Looks like the slave class looks pretty well groomed and pretty cut according to standard. Much like
soldiers,
right? But we're not talking about armies. We're talking about the rank and file of people. If I have me'ilah on hair that grows, I have more of a philosophical answer that a person's own hair, a person may be able to groom the way he or she wants to keep their own hair. If I have to pay a penalty for when I cut the hair, I experience me'ila. I take something that's really consecrated. Now, I know that the hair only goes to a certain level, and there is a slave market that I'm using to value the person, but I think there's an underlying argument here about whether or not there's any kind of sense of one's personhood, one's personal dignity that comes through the hair that may be at play.
So is land in general valued more highly than movable property, or does it make some difference?
It depends which land.
Yeah, I mean some land is.
I mean the context of.
In the context of the property consecrated to the Beit HaMikdash, I think they're just looking for money.
Beit HaMikdash is going to need money. They don't want to be manager of land.
Well, they want their fruits.
Sometimes they wanted to actually have some land because they wanted to sell the goods that came from that land at a very high price for when you actually made your pilgrimage to the Beit HaMikdash. The cynical economic look about this sugya is that it is all about movable property, and it's all about what they're actually taxing people and whether or not they can get a fifth.
Yeah. And if the rule is that the penalty is a fifth, you give it back plus a fifth. If I can take it and make 80%, I'll pay the fifth.
Right.
Maybe they're trying to...
Right. It may be that somebody could calculate their way out of really feeling any penalty at all, right?
Yeah.
Question.
Yeah.
What happens in case, and that may be discussed or not, is there any kind of commentary towards if you consecrate a slave, let's say a woman who's pregnant and then has a child?
No.
Is there such a thing?
No. No discussion. None that I've found. None that I've had.
If it's an Eved Ibri, the child is free. If it's an Eved Knani, I think the child is a slave.
Well, that's not... I mean... We're talking...
He's a free man.
We're not talking... We're talking about a consecrated slave to the Beit HaMikdash, so I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah.
In the Hebrew slave department, Ron's right, if you're just talking about in a family, the child is not an Eved Ibri, and in the Canaanite slave... domain. You're talking about children of slaves being slaves. And you're talking about, again, the discussion being more in line with consecrating monetary values
right.
to the Beit HaMikdash versus actually people.
Right.
So, I'm not sure that it would go there and they have no reason for that in a certain way.
But then the monetary value increases that action.
But you need to look with your Ben if it's a Jewish kid, even if it's a son of a slave.
Redeeming the firstborn. Any other thoughts about the discussion?
So a sheep is considered like land or
movable? No, a sheep is movable property.
Even though if you can sell it, you can use the wool. And if you use it, then you're going to penalize.
I mean, isn't it?
Because that's a normal shearing, like property that grows.
That's
unlike hair, grows long.
So, right. So if you wanted to say that this braita ultimately informs us potentially about that wool which grows from a sheep's back, the question for us would be whether or not we could find a sugya that deals with that question, and I would have to do a search in the Gemara for that. I'm not recalling right now. Whether or not there's a specific question about whether or not a consecrated sheep can gain us benefit through the growth of its wool on its back. But it's a great question. Can a consecrated... I'm going to write this one. Kevin's or animal gain us benefit? Perhaps this next... What's that?
But without Pi'ilah, I mean, why wouldn't, if you've consecrated your sheep to the Beit HaMikdash, why would you be entitled to the proceeds of its wool as opposed to the Beit HaMikdash being entitled?
Only because of the complication of the laws of Me'ilah in Braitas, just like this, with this comparison to a person and the fields versus movable property, karka versus the sadeh.
Well,
and
as
so
we've already established, the sheep is, well, it's really, really big. It's movable property. So I'm just curious, what's the... If I consecrate my sheep to the Beit HaMikdash, it isn't my understanding that I've consecrated my entire sheep. I mean, ultimately, I can bring the money, or I can bring the sheep with me too, right, to the Beit HaMikdash,
yeah,
if I've consecrated something,
yeah,
that small.
It depends if they're hungry, though.
No,
you can bring it. You can bring it. It just can't, you know.
I'm not asking philosophically. I'm saying
no,
what
I hear
the
you.
World meaning of what I've done. I just would have thought that it means the entire sheep. So
right. The reason why I'm open to it is because, yep, of the next piece of Gemara that I know, which is in our Gemara, which says that if I actually consecrate my land, at some point, some of the stuff on the land becomes movable property, and I have a question about what do I do with that movable property? Can I benefit it or not? Benefit from it or not? Right?
I guess that part of what I'm saying is the significance of the meaning of me consecrating a sheep to Beit HaMikdash because of the animal itself for the sacrifices and the meat, or is it understood that I've given the entire animal?
Well, it is the entire animal in the way that they used to use the entire animal.
Right.
Right? Remember that we saw in Shabbos that they had all this discussion about how the different parts of the animal were sold for profit based on some of the stuff that they were talking about with even the scribal world that existed at the time. Let's look at this,
yes,
next piece and we'll see if there's any open door. But the other reason I'm really debating it is because it's a good question by way of the application of a legal concept. Okay. Ron, this is also going to be the place where I think it touches a little bit on the relationship between
labor and slave,
and it's going to touch on the issue of laborers and slaves in the way that someone even asks a friend to become a guardian of something. So if I ask you to do it for free and I have to treat you this way, it may mean that I treat you differently if I pay you.
Then I'm obligated.
But I still think that all these questions are wrapped up in just one short, small little passage here.
We discussed that already in a couple of sections 2 years ago. The person's a guardian to your material.
There is a different guardian to material or laborer, like an employee.
Where was it, Jack?
Right. When we studied in the past,
right,
it was guardian,
a guardian
of pauper.
Right, it's the pauper, right. Where are we studying, Jay?
At some point, you must have learned Baba Metzia.
Baba Metzia!
No,
Baba Metzia,
oh, you mean
Jay!
Yes.
Yeah, you must have learned that.
Yeah,
we didn't study it, but you must have learned it some.
We learned
some.
Baba Metzia. We learned it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
No, he's been here already 3 years.
All right,
fine.
All right.
In the recent 5 years or so.
We are still young, wasn't
it? It's an
ancient time. It was yesterday.
All right.
You don't remember? The guardian. I'm drunk, but I don't remember. I just told you the guardian. Okay, go on.
Okay. 39A2, right column.
I'm sorry, I do remember now what you're talking about. Okay. Somebody, you take care of something for somebody, and then somebody steals it.
And then somebody steals it. Were you responsible?
Then.
Was he responsible?
Okay,
did he run away? Did you run away?
Okay.
Okay, fine.
Oh, and then you can chase him through the field.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Do you remember, R.E.?
Yep.
See? We all remember.
Let's get back to sheep.
Okay, we're going to have people guarding land here for a minute. Lema hane tana'e kahane tana'i. Shall we say that these Tana'im, the Tanakama and Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, who we've been talking about, debate the same issue as these Tana'im of this Mishnah? Let's look at this other Mishnah. Ditnan is different than Ditanya, right? Ditnan is going to introduce the Mishnah, a Mishnah. For we've learned in a Mishnah, and that Mishnah is over in Shavuot 42b, Rabbi Meir says, Yesh Tevarim Shehem Kakarka, some things are like land, they're attached to the land. Ve'einan kikarka, and yet they're not legally classified as land. So, Ve'en chachamim odim lo. But the sages don't agree with him. Ketzad. So, give me an example. Eser gifanim tu'unot masarti lach. I've entrusted you to act as a guardian with 10 vines full of grapes. They're on my property. V'halach omer ein on el chamesh. But he goes and he says in court, the litigant who's looking to make an oath, because it's in shvuos, talking about oaths here, and what a person makes an oath about. And the other litigant says, Rak Chamesh, there were only 5. You said 10? 5. Rabbi Meir Mechayev, Rabbi Meir obligates the defendant to swear to support his claim. Remember that oaths are big time. So you have to take an oath to support that claim. V'chachamim omrim, and the sages say, Kol hamichu bar lakarka, anything that's connected to the land, harei hu kakarka, is treated as land, and therefore the defendant doesn't need to swear concerning the 5 disputed vines. Meaning what? Right. Meaning what?
I don't know.
That he's not responsible.
Oh.
The animals came
and
they gave fun.
But
I have a...
So whatever's there is there.
Right?
He doesn't
need to swear. Why is it treated as land? Wait a minute. I'm asking. Why is it treated as land? And what difference does that make? I don't have to swear.
Because it's not actually land. It's a construct of some kind. Where it's separated. So I don't have to swear.
One says it's like movable property, and therefore I have to make an oath. And one says it's not like movable property. It's actually like the land. Therefore, I have no oath to make.
But he can...
Right?
We need not swear concerning land.
Because land can't move.
No, but what, I'm missing something. What's the relationship? The concept of shvuot's got to do with whether something's movable or not moved.
If something's movable...
Yeah.
Then it can be stolen.
It can be stolen, eaten, blown away,
it
cut off.
It
can walk.
Yeah, but
sure, but why does that have to do with whether the person has to swear that there were 10 as opposed to 5?
Because it's what he saw. You can't.
Because it's easier to lie about.
If you weren't there at the same moment, you wouldn't know.
See, exactly.
But land is land.
You can't lie about it.
Donald Trump
land. It's
beautiful.
Look again, what's in front of you? It's easier to lie about it if it's movable. Yeah, sure it is.
But I have a question.
What's the question?
Is when I gave him the 10 vine or to keep, I didn't take him and we counted together. You know, there is one very pure rule. Money and weapon, when you give to somebody else, you need to check. If I gave you $100, you need to count. If I give you a weapon, you need to check that it's empty. These are two things that are mandatory in transactions of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
So if I tell you, hey, I want to, you to keep for me the 10 vine, I'm taking you to the land, and I will count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
So
you can't. I don't know why there is an argument.
Well, there was.
These were attached to land.
Because
so
one grew
there.
Out of another, they weren't all distinct.
No,
they didn't have
they
names,
weren't cut
they
and
weren't
handed to be watched.
It's like hair.
Right,
yeah.
It's like hair.
So it should be 20. If it gave him 10, then if it grows, it should be 20.
Not the vine, the grapes are like that.
What I'm confused about is how do we know the person who said there were 10 isn't lying?
The argument
exactly. That's I just...
Well...
There is no second...
Right, so...
I mean, the defendant has to...
So sometimes in the Gemara, the case comes with the case. This guy comes and says there were 10. How do we know there weren't? Well, if he says there are 5, and these are like... What? When is they're like what when I have to swear? They're like movable property.
So it's not movable.
It's not movable.
So I don't need to swear.
So I don't really need to swear.
But you could pick it up and move it.
Before. In other words, if there were 5 there now...
You can pick up a 5
now,
and move it.
Now you're getting into also all kinds of what we call in the realm of the Gemara presents the case, and you have to just go with the case, right? You can make a what's called a klutz kasha on any case. You can actually trip yourself up and try to say, how do we know this and how do we know? And it's true, some of those are not klutzy. Some of those are just kashas. They're good kashas. They're good questions on it. In this case, fundamentally, there's a difference of opinion about movable property and land. With movable property, they want you to take the higher level oath. And that is the oath that says, I only saw five. You might have said 10. There are five there. Oath. And then, anything that's connected to land is treated as land, according to the opinion of the other person, doesn't require any oath. To me, land is somewhat changeable. The growth of coming off the land is somewhat, you know, not exactly discernible. Everything coming out of there is as if it's the land. And if you ask them to keep it, whether it's 10 or whether it's 5,
whatever it is.
Okay? If at all the thinking of the Gemara or, you know, Ravashi here is to put this little piece here because they're hearkening back to our Tanaim who were arguing about whether or not I could use a slave after I consecrate his value to the Veda Mikdash, right? Am I saying I used him up to now, I have a value for the slave and future work and whatever happens with that slave is mine, but I'm going to evaluate him at this moment and it kind of goes along with I use him to this point, I'm saying here I consecrate his value, right? And it doesn't include kind of future earnings, future growth, all these things, then it kind of gets me back into the discussion of which direction I go with the way that I see the slave's work. Was it work up to then? Was it work beyond then? What kind of benefit am I getting? The piece here with the... What's that?
Guardian.
With the guardian is that if I say 10 and he takes an oath that it was only 5, right, do I believe him? Or do we make him swear? And that piece within the little passage, getting back to your question philosophically about how we relate to people we ask to do business, is that if we allow him to take an oath, if we take Rabbi Meir's position, is that the stronger position of trust or the weaker position of trust when it comes to a guardian? I think Davka, it's the stronger.
If you force if you don't believe somebody's word, and you force him to swear, then you don't believe him. Then it's a weak. You don't believe him.
No, you're allowing him to take advantage of the higher level of protection. So
right.
He's swearing. I mean, in other words, he's telling the truth.
But why he should believe you?
I mean, I swore.
It's an open...
Is it also a question of credibility?
Well, I think they're saying he's credible, both in terms of the statement and the swearing in God's name. I wouldn't allow someone who I didn't think was credible to actually make a shmuel.
Wait, wait. Let the rabbi finish. Yeah. What?
To make an oath.
You wouldn't let.
Well, but then that's oxymoron. If you've already judged him before he's made the oath.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to me like that's reasonable.
But if you take that position, then he's not allowed to testify at all.
Right. No, I'm just saying to what the rabbi just said. Not what.
Yeah.
So what are you saying? You're saying that if I let him take the oath, what?
Does that
no.
That's then the only time I can really believe him?
If you don't let him take the oath,
you argue.
If you don't let him take the oath, then you don't trust him at all because you're trying to save him from taking a bad making an oath that you don't believe he's telling the truth.
So I could believe him, but I don't want him to take the oath because he might self-incriminate. Before God,
but he owe you five pieces of something.
No. So I don't think it has to do. If you don't want to take the oath, it doesn't have to do with his believability. It has to do with what he's doing by making a false oath.
To undermine his.
I mean, it's also taking away his autonomy. You're taking a away completely. You're saying you're you're not responsible enough to take
should
the oath.
Decide if you might.
I think the presumption is he's being honest in taking the oath. Otherwise,
right?
Yeah.
You're not preventing anyone from taking it.
Well, you shouldn't.
If you feel you have a responsibility to help people not make false oaths because the consequences are so severe, then you have an obligation to say, no, I don't want you to do that.
But you're
undermining his credibility. By
sure.
I agree.
Yeah. Like having a defendant, you tell him, you better not testify.
Right. Something like that.
It's the police union with the policeman.
It's interesting that they never took inventory before.
We don't know the whole idea.
You're back on inventory.
You're on the same horse.
No, I hear you. We have no oath of the first guy.
Right.
And
we don't have a statement that is correct.
We might have liked to have seen that. I'm with you. We don't have that. What we have is this guy who says five, and we have a disagreement between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim.
Is the assumption that if somebody takes an oath, that he's telling the truth?
Well, one would hope, because they are protecting against swearing falsely. They really want to protect against it.
So we're assuming that even if he's not telling the truth, if he takes an oath, he's going to be believed?
Yeah.
Agreement.
However, if he takes the oath, we really believe him.
And if it's not true, he's in trouble.
Either way, Rabbi Meir or the Chachamim. One says take an oath, the other says what?
Don't.
Anything that was there is like karka, and what?
Karka?
Is like land. And then you don't need an oath.
Because
it grows and this and that. And it could have been, you know, that you asked him to guard it, but there was natural blowing away. Maybe an animal came and ate it in between the moment that you told him to go guard it. And therefore there's no problems here. Either way, frankly, there's no problem. And here's my point back to what this is really saying about the guardian. Who do we trust? Do we trust the guy who said there was 10? Really, in terms of the limud? Or does the Gemara's passage indicate that we're trusting the guy who's saying five a little bit more?
Yes.
Trusting the second guy.
Five.
Yeah.
I think it's the second guy.
Ron thinks it's the 10 guy.
And I would say that the Gemara is hinting again, and these are only hints, and these are leitmotifs throughout Gemara. And so the shomer, the guy who's acting as the guardian, has a little bit more of an advantage by way of the system approach here. And if that's a reflection back on any of the piece about the slave, okay, it's saying kind of either which way, you got to put some level of trust in this person, and we're talking about a person.
Yeah, so the master is the guardian of the slave. The minute he kiddush the slave to the temple, so we need to trust him not to steal the heir of the slave, so to speak. That's the parallel.
I think you mean the hair, not the ear.
The hair, you know.
So the giver, you're trusting the giver, the donor.
Well,
the party that's giving the, because it's a different party. The motivation is different, right? Because if that's true,
I wasn't thinking of exactly like that, but it's an interesting.
Consecrating the whatever it is, movable or immovable property. And in the other case, you're trusting the one that's receiving. You're trusting the bailee.
Mm-hmm.
Not the giver. You're trusting the one who's responsible for taking care of it.
Right.
Which is not, it's like they're not in the same...
I was seeing it a little bit differently. You're trusting the person who you entrusted, right, with the care of the 10 grapevines. That person says, no, there's only five. Right? We trust them. Yeah?
Well, that's what you're saying, yeah.
That's what I think that piece is saying. With the other piece of the sugya, with the slave and the master, I'm thinking that what the commentary might be saying is that if the deposit of the donation by the master of the slave is for all this money. I'm donating this amount of money to the temple. But the slave himself, right, has a little hair growth, does a little extra work, gives me more than the value that I pledged, or less, for that matter, if you go with Rebbe Meir, says we have to trust him when he says only five, regardless of value. What I'm responsible for is the amount that I said, but we trust that the slave, whose work will either become productive in more of a way or less than a way, might just happen either which way based on who the slave is. Like the field could have been depleted five stalks for some reason. My slave could have also lost value in the market, but I still have to pay the amount that I said. And I trust that the slave's value in terms of in my realm, that this person, I still have to take care of him.
So you're trusting the one that has the responsibility for whatever the subject is?
Correct.
So the one that has the control over it, basically?
But both parties. And based on the...
See it the one who has control over it. If I'm still control the slave, I haven't given the slave, I haven't taken the slave and put him in the precinct. And I haven't, and I'm the bailee, I'm the one that's supposed to take care of the grapevine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the one that's the one that is the most immediately responsible
okay.
for what's in front of them. That's the one that you're trusting. That's what both...
I see your read. Nice.
In the case of a slave, could you not deliver the slave to the Beit Midrash?
To the Beit Midrash?
Yeah. It's yours now. If the slave has lost value in the interim.
Yeah. You know, the question of delivering the actual slave versus the monetary value was a little bit dealt with within the sugyas that we looked at, and pretty much we're in the space of agreeing here that we're talking about the monetary value of that person.
So why, when I declare a donation, why I don't say 100 shekel instead of saying my slave Abraham? You know, why, yeah. If this is the case, if Beit HaMikdash needs the money and I need to give them the value of my property, why I don't declare a donation, of monetary donation, and disconnect myself from variable value by season or by
collateral
or whatever.
Good. I think that is an overarching question that the Gemara is actually encouraging us to ask. What is the formula of donating this person? What is this really all about? There is a possibility that this whole discussion should be, are you talking really about donating a person? Are you really talking about even donating the value of a person? Isn't the tikkun olam that we're suggesting that we should sanctify the individual? And by naming the individual, what does it actually mean for me to consecrate that individual to the Beit HaMikdash? What do you think it might mean?
To let them free.
To let them free. And not only to let them free, but to make them what?
Jewish.
Jewish. Part of Am Kadosh. If I makdish my servant, I make that servant Kadosh. Kadosh like Kadoshim to you. You shall be holy people, according to the Torah, right? The Parsha in Leviticus. And that is the context, because we've basically talked about the whole content of the next little piece within our discussion here. That's the point of the piece that comes on the heels of the grapes and whether or not ripening grapes and grapes that are on the vine for too long are actually part of the land or they're movable property. And those technical details give way to what is on page 39A3. So take a look, 39A3. A ruling is stated in the name of Rav that a slave who was declared ownerless goes free. Ki salik Rabbi Chiya bar Yosef, when Rabbi Chiya bar Yosef went up to the land of Israel, Amar lahai shmata de Rav Kame de Rav Yochanan, he related the following ruling of Rav in the presence of Rabbi Yochanan. Amar le Amar Rav Hachi, Rabbi Yochanan says to him, did Rav really, Amar le Amar Rav Hachi, did Rav really say this? Gemara wonders like this, Vahu lo Amar Hachi, but Rabbi Yochanan himself did not say the same thing. V'hamar Ula Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ula said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Hamachkir Avdo, the one declares a slave ownerless, Yetzei L'Cheirut, he goes out to freedom. V'tzarich Get Shichur.
Yeah,
and requires a document of emancipation. What's that?
Yeah, but if somebody is mafkir, there is a difference between l'shachrer v'lafkir. L'afkir is let go. L'shachrer is to give him the get. So it's a little bit... it's a little bit free.
Wait,
understanding.
What is mafkir?
L'afkir... Isha Mufkeret, for example, or
no, Efker. It's not Isha Mufkeret.
No,
it's not
Efker.
It's not modern use of Hefker.
Okay, so I'm wrong. Okay.
It's not the modern use of Hefker. What is Lafkir in the Talmudic parlance of the economic reality of Hefker?
It's not your property anymore.
It's not your property. To vacate.
Yeah.
Vacate. It is completely to say, this is not my property. That's it. There's no overtones here of this kind of debased world. A mafkir avdo yetzei l'cheirut. One declares the slave ownerless. He goes out to freedom. V'tzarich get shichur. So, I just point this out, that this is what's on the heels of the discussion of those kinds of people who have been discussed in terms of being makdish, who have been consecrated to the Beit HaMikdash. And if you'll recall, what we had was the discussion at the beginning of this section about whether or not the whole notion of emancipation really happened with a slave who was makdish.
Makir and makdish is the same.
So maybe. And what they're trying to figure out by coming back to this verb is, what are you really saying to begin with? Are you talking about making this guy like land? Are you talking about making this guy like movable property? Are you talking about his value now? Are you talking about his value later? He's a human being. He's going to change. He has, you know, power of 10 now in his biceps. He's got the power of 5 days from now. This is what I'm getting across with this other kind of piece that we read. He changes, the land changes, it goes, it grows, it withers. So then let's turn immediately to the conversation of a person who declares a slave ownerless, and what does he need? A get of emancipation. And the Gemara explains Rabbi Yochanan's surprise. Hachi kamarle. This is what Rabbi Yochanan meant to say to Rabbi Chiya. Amar Rav kavati. Did Rav really say in accordance with my ruling? Second reaction to this, Rabbi Yochanan. Ve'ika de'amre. There are those who say lo saimuha kame. In relating Rav's ruling, Rabbi Chiya did not complete it in the presence of Rabbi Yochanan. Amar le. Ve'lo amar Rav tzarich get shichur. But did not Rav not also say that the slave requires a document of emancipation?
The Gemara comments, for Rabbi Yochanan Latame, and this is Rabbi Yochanan consistent with his own reasoning, the Amar Ula, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ula said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Hamachkir Avdo Yetze Lecheirut, if one declares a slave owner, the slave goes out to freedom, Vitzarich Get Shichur. And the slave needs a document of emancipation. And ultimately, the conversation wound its way towards this moment of the freedom of a slave who is basically ownerless. Coming on the heels of this consecration discussion and how we consider a slave in terms of the category of law. Gemara discusses the ruling of Rabbi Yochanan further. Gufa. The text states, Amar Ula Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Ula says in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Hamachkir Avdo Yetze Lecheru. If one declares the slave owner, he goes out to freedom. The Tzarich Get Shichur and requires a document of emancipation to permit him to what?
Marry a Jewish lady.
Marry a Jewish woman. So I think there is, on a page of Gemara, sometimes, a conversation that starts here, and then a turn towards a discussion that might be asking a question, but not exactly in the stamaitic way, the totally logical or, let's say, Talmudic parlance in the way that it's set up. Like, didn't we see this sugya about the one who declares his slave ownerless, and isn't that parallel to consecrating slaves anyway? So why are you telling me about all this consecration? Why are you telling me about whether or not he's like land or whether he's like movable property when really we're talking about freeing him and we should be talking about freeing him? And to me, it's set up in the Gemara in this way so that the question is begged on the heels of such kind of particular legal splicing when it comes to the position of the slave. That is the beginning of it. Then it's going to go further. Ger Shemit. Rabbi Abba is going to challenge Ula from here. A convert dies. Right? And now we're talking about who in the story? A convert. Assuming we have converts. Uviz buz Yisrael nechasav. And Jews seized his now ownerless possessions. V'hayu v'hen avadim bein gedolim v'hen ketanim. And among them were both adult and minor slaves. Kanu atzman b'nei chorin. The slaves have automatically acquired their freedom. Ah, so acquisition of this property by these Jews, perhaps, again, confronting the Beit HaMikdash, can you really acquire human beings? In any which way, shape, or form? Abba Shaul Omer, Abba Shaul says, Gidolim kanu atzman b'nei chorin. I'll agree that the adults actually become free. Ketanim kol amachzik behen zacha behen. But, here's an opinion that's going to be very harsh by way of the whole system of trying to figure it out economically and trying to keep them as property. Whoever takes possession of them has acquired them. So when the convert died and the possessions became ownerless, the slaves, they acquire themselves, become free men, and they preempt any attempt by another Jew to acquire them. But since minors can't legally acquire property, they can't, quote-unquote, acquire themselves. But note, and I'll say this in a way that I think there is some impact and import of this. Does Abba have the title Rav?
No, his father.
Abba Shaul Omer. And so Abba Shaul is kind of this authority, but I think set up not to be the same level of authority as Rabbi Abba challenged Ula in the same way that he's named later, Abba Shaul. So maybe his learning is not as strong. Maybe they don't like this idea that Kitanim kol machzik behen zacha bahen.
But if they are efker because the ger died, they should be free. Just by the definition.
I mean, I assume this doesn't pertain to the children of the adult slaves. Because in theory, of course, if it did, the adult slaves, once they're free, they could acquire the minors since they're their children. I assume this means unrelated minor children.
Unrelated.
In which case, so they need someone to take care of them, I guess.
The no, theory. But if they are, if the boss is dead, they are efker. And if they are, by definition, efker, they are free. That's
the
what
adults.
We started before.
The adults in the same...
No,
the
but it doesn't matter. The children
yeah,
should
I would imagine you're right, and that... You know, there is a systemic approach to make sure children don't fall into a trap, into you know, a really bad. You know, they have to be taken care of. They should be taken care of. And at the same time, the question is whether or not there could be some other kind of approach to that system. Now, even with the adults, there's going to be a question. Because, remember, they want to make sure that there's some documentation. And that was part of the whole fix of society that was flowing through this Talmudic passage from the time that we started with fixing the world through the way that a woman and a man have to deal with a get.
What I'm asking you is my assumption correct? In other words, this doesn't mean that people can come in and take away the children of the adult slaves, separate the families. I'm saying this is pertaining to unrelated minors.
Well, I thought you had put if they were not related, and I was agreeing that it sounded like a good concept. It sounds as though when the Jewish people, according to this last limud, went and acquired this hefker, that indeed they could with a Canaanite slave family, because the children who were born of that Canaanite slave became slave to, quote-unquote, the master, right, the owner, that there could very well be a difference of opinion about those minors, even of a family.
Yeah, what I'm saying is, am I correct, though, assuming that the adult slaves become free, at that point they are able to take their own children, they would be the first one.
Nobody said that on the page
right,
of Gemara,
okay.
But I would imagine that indeed could be the way that the system played out.
If he left an estate, if he left descendants, the convert who died, are his slaves ownerless at his death, or do they pass to the...
Well, if he declared them ownerless, right now we're in that question. If he didn't declare them ownerless, then...
Well,
you know, it's a big issue.
He has now ownerless possessions. But if he had a wife and children who survived him, would his possessions be ownerless?
Yeah, and his children, in that case that you're saying now, his children would actually inherit the estate.
So they would not be ownerless.
They would not be ownerless. In this case, they were ownerless. Whether he declared them ownerless or he had nobody claiming the property in this particular case.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Stein's house.
What does he say?
That this, it refers to a convert that has no family dies. There's nobody to inherit his property.
Right.
Not just a convert who dies. But
what's the difference between a Jew and a convert in that case? If the Jew died with no children and no wife, what would happen with his slave?
Nice, because we were going to go back to the question of why does it start with Ger?
Yeah, right.
Why might you think it starts with Ger? Because the ger has no family in Israel. Right? If it's a ger, and he's the only one who became Jewish and part of the Am Kadosh, the holy people, therefore he has no other Jewish family. And what is the then seizure all about? Keeping the property within the Jewish community.
What if his parents and his siblings also converted?
That's a whole possibility, but in this case, again, and that's why Steinsaltz is going to point it out.
still is with Ron asked. What's the difference between a Jew with no family and a kid with no family? It would be the same thing.
Well, one would figure with a Jewish person who had that experience that there would be some claim by a next of kin. And then there's a whole kind of series of answers about who inherits within family structures. And if no children, a brother, but if there was a wife, the wife, if there were no children, all these kinds of questions would be answered by the family tree and the lines of inheritance that we establish. Here we're talking about without lines of inheritance.
But who's written a document of emancipation for these slaves? Now let's ask the question. You just assumed that these adults actually acquired their own freedom. But don't we need a get shichur? Don't we need an actual...
Yeah, but we need a shichur if we want them to marry Jewish women.
Ah, very nice. But isn't that the point, that we might want them to be able to marry within the community?
You need to ask them, sir.
According to Rabbi Yochanan, how could they marry a Jewish woman? Ula dismisses the objection, though. Amar, damehai midrabanan kidol gamrein shishmata. This Rabbi Abba seems like one to whom people never explain the law. Now, we ended there the last time by saying, oh, he wants them to still be able to get married, and this was a fun little quip, and we said, okay, Abba, you don't know the law well enough. And I pointed out that this was a way to actually allow those people to become part of the community entirely. All right, but let's just look at what we have in the continuation. Vatamemai. What indeed is the reason of the rule that even Rabbi Yochanan agrees that these slaves do not require a document of emancipation? Okay, that's what Ula dismissed Rabbi Abba's objection. Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman said, Kesavar Ula avdo de ger ki ishto. Ula holds that a slave of a deceased convert is like his wife. Ma ishto mishtalacha belo get, just as the convert's wife is released upon his death without receiving a bill of divorce, and death does it, af avadav mishtalashichim belo get. The slaves are released without receiving a document, and ve'ihachi, and if that's so, that slaves are comparable to a woman in this case, afilu Yisrael namin, even slaves of a born Jew who has heirs should go free when he dies. Why, then, are they inherited by his children? Ah, I'm going to have a little objection to the whole inheritance piece. Amar Kra, for the verse states regarding slaves, Vehit nachaltem otam livneichem acharechem lereshet u'achuzah, and you shall hold them as an inheritance for your children after you, to inherit as a possession. And ihachi, but if that's so, that the Torah is saying that we're going to have lines of inheritance, we're going to inherit slaves. It follows that if one declares a slave ownerless and then dies, the slave should also not require a document of emancipation, since he is not inherited by the master's heirs. Then why did Amemar say that if one declares a slave ownerless and dies, that slave has no remedy? Oh, back to a problem like Rabbi Abba's, that the slave has no remedy, meaning what? That the slave can never marry into the people. Why does the master's death not automatically free the slave?
It frees the slave, but it doesn't give him a get shichur, so he cannot marry a Jewish woman. That's what.
The Gemara concludes like this. De amemar kashya. You're right. If we were going to go with a amemar, we'd have trouble. But what do we have instead?
They buy themselves.
We have a takana. We had a rejection by Ula. We ultimately say, if it is by a Meymar, it is hard, it is difficult. We call them out individually, and we say then, there is takana, that they actually do become free. And they can marry someone Jewish. They can marry into the community.
We want to, if Jay's Svara about the minors is right. There are minors who have no place else to go. Maybe that's why we seize them, if you will, or property-wise, assign them a place. Could say there's a little bit of difficulty here with that lesson, with that limud, with that concept, though, if we're not talking solely about the children who have no parental units around left. Maybe they died. Or the children who are quote-unquote movable property, who people think they could split up from their families. Even worse. Those are hard realities to deal with in this whole concept of having slavery as the institution to begin with. But when we're talking about trying to expand the possibility of the community growing and the marriages to Jews happening, we indicate what the difficulties are, and we ultimately have a couple of times the lessons in the limud, the learning out the possibility that we can get around the question of actually giving them documentation and assume that they are free, just like the woman doesn't need a get whose
husband died.
And therefore, in the Perek, in the chapter, if we're so worried that everybody needs a get, by this time, page 39, does everybody actually need documentation?
No.
And we have to be clear that there are those times you have to be very, very strict about how one gets a get and how it's written and all the right pieces it needs. And you also have to be careful to not prevent the possibility of the community of Jews growing and marriages to happen and legitimate children to be born within your precincts, even given some of the hiccups and the problems that arise within the system of law and the social system that we have established here in that picture of rabbinic times that we get from this Masechta.
Thank you.